The first plenary session is sponsored by PwC and will focus on data-driven decisions, the way of the future. Chris Dolman will be providing an overview, moving from historical lessons to the current reality of data-driven decisions and onto cultural change. Hugh Miller will focus on software, tools and techniques, and Chow Chow will present on behavioural economics and non-traditional roles. So each presenter will be presenting for 20 minutes. There will again be an opportunity for your questions to be answered in the second half of the plenary session. So please listen to all speakers and then we'll have the session at the end. And you will again be sent an SMS asking for your speaker feedback at the start of the Q&A. This is a different link to the last one. So Chris Dolman has wide-ranging insurance industry experience, having worked across multiple countries as both an advisor and in industry, in both traditional and non-traditional roles. He is currently GM Analytics at IAG, helping to drive data-driven decisions making across all aspects of the organisation. Please welcome Chris Dolman.
Thank you, and thanks for having me come and talk to you today. So, just get the mic adjusted to my obscene height. So what I want to talk about today is the move towards becoming data-driven, which a lot of companies, both in the insurance sector and outside the insurance sector, are talking about becoming. So this phrase, becoming data-driven, means different things to different people, so I want to share my perspectives on what I think that means and sort of invite you to discuss that later on in Q&A. So I want to describe what that means by means of answering a couple of questions that I typically get asked and some of my standard stylized cartoony examples which I like to provide to people to help illustrate. So for those of you who know me outside of this this forum, you might have seen some of this stuff before, and apologies if you have. So first question that I get asked very often, what does data-driven actually mean? So let's illustrate with a stylized example. Here's an unhappy chap. Let's call the unhappy chap Bob. Bob's not very happy because the line's going down, and when lines go down, that's normally not a good thing. In this case, the line going down is Bob's sales, and Bob's a sales manager, and so Bob's really not happy. Bob's manager's not happy. Bob gets home in the evening, and he's grumpy, and so Bob's wife's not happy. It's not a happy story. Bob's got a decision to make. Bob has to work out what should he do. So in a traditional decision-making framework, this is what Bob does. He comes up with a bunch of ideas, and there's lots of different ways that people can come up with ideas. In Bob's case, he comes up with some ideas himself. He has a nice workshop with some of his colleagues. He asks his manager. He does a whole range of things to come up with potentially hundreds of ideas about what he could do. But then Bob can't do anything. Can't do everything, rather. Maybe he can't do anything. So Bob has to work out how to filter those ideas down to something that's actually doable. So, you know, he goes and works out what his manager thinks he should do. He looks at what he might have done before in a similar sort of situation, works out what's practical, and he makes a decision about what he's actually going to do to change his sales. And he puts that into market, and then he has a look at the same chart, and Bob's happy again because his sales went up. And so Bob concludes that obviously he made the right decision because the line went the right way. It's a bit problematic because Bob doesn't really know if something else actually happened at the same time to cause the line to go up, and so Bob doesn't really know that his action caused the improvement in sales. But unfortunately, in a traditional decision-making sort of framework, this has now created a myth in Bob's mind about what to do when the line goes down, and so in future when the line goes down, he'll try the same thing again potentially, and that's not great. But typically this is the way a lot of decisions get made in traditional sort of corporates in a lot of environments. And so let's think about what we might do if we're going to be more data-driven. So here's a similar looking but far more intelligent person. So let's call her Betty. Betty's far smarter than Bob, but she has the same sort of problem, right? Her sales have gone down and we need to, you know, work out what to do. So the first thing Betty does, very importantly, is Betty knows that no matter what ideas she comes up with, she doesn't know what the answer actually is. Okay, so Betty has to first go through the same process as Bob and come up with some ideas about what she might put in market. But then she's not going to make the decision about what the actual right thing to do is. So she's going to, in a stylized example, let's just come up with some stuff, right? So she's got two options. She decides are viable. She could cut her new business prices by 5% for customers that are authenticated on the website, or she could send out some direct marketing. Both of these things might cause her sales to go up. And let's say her business has got a rule that says she can only do one thing or the other for any individual customer. She's not allowed to do both for whatever reason. So a very stylized example. But Betty knows that she doesn't know the right answer to this question. She doesn't know what's going to work for whom. She doesn't know if any of these ideas are actually going to work at all. And so Betty should run an experiment to actually work out what idea actually works and what idea doesn't. So to design that experiment, she cuts her population up into slices, and she randomly assigns the different ideas, the different actions, to people in the population. And she does that randomly, so that then she can actually analyse the results and understand cause and effect after the fact. So in this sort of example, you know, we're experimenting on a certain portion of that pie chart. A third of the people get nothing new. Very important to keep a control group aside, so we can actually measure against something and in the same sort of time period with no sort of confounding factors going on. And the other two-thirds of people, we, you know, evenly split, in this case, the two different interactions. So we still don't know what's going to work at this point, but we're actually designing an experiment to capture data to tell us what's actually going to work. And then we analyse the results. Now, and this is very simplistic again, but in this case, you know, doing nothing is the blue line, and you know, for all age ranges here, both strategies seem to have a positive impact. That's good. And we can see in this case, you know, older people react differently to younger people, it seems, and you know, the discount seems more attractive to older people and the marketing seems more attractive to younger people. In the real world, what you want to be doing is looking at all the information you might have about those people, which might be a very sort of multidimensional problem, okay? And so, you know, this is just looking at a one-dimensional view of data, but actually we want to be thinking about all the different attributes we know about customers and how to, you know, segment them into which strategy works for whom is then quite a complex sort of multidimensional problem, which you certainly couldn't do by eye. So then, you know, Betty's got a nice decision she can make by using the results of that experiment. She can quite easily say, you know, under 40 should get the marketing, over 40 should get the discount, and then importantly, we still maintain a control group when we put that strategy in market so we can measure what actually has happened. Because if we don't do that, we're still not going to know actually what's happened in the real world. And so here, the dotted line represents the control group, and the line's gone up, and Betty's very happy, and Betty knows she should be happy because it's actually improved. So it's important to observe what this sort of decision making isn't. So this isn't people sitting around the board table with lots of charts and data and information trying to decide what's actually going to be the right strategy. Okay? If we go back to the, you know, chart on the left, if we think about a sort of complex decision space that might exist in the real world where we might have, you know, hundreds or thousands of attributes about customers and how they might react. If we're going to work out which strategy works for whom, we're simply not going to be able to do that by sitting around a board table deciding what the right decision is. We need to write some algorithms, write some code, run some models to actually work out what the right strategies are. So this isn't data-driven decision-making. But when you say to people we're going to be more data-driven, this is often what people think it means. So, you know, I'm finally going to get the report I've always wanted. You probably should get the report you've always wanted, but I'm not necessarily talking about that here. So I've come up with a phrase which I'm using which seems to work. So this is what I'm now calling data-informed. So people are more informed by data. That's not a bad thing, but it's not being driven by the data. So the important word here is driven, whereas people often focus on the word data, and that's actually not what we're talking about here. The important word is driven. So if we're data-informed, then, you know, human input's a very important part of the decision-making process still. There's a lot of judgment going on. And for a lot of decisions, that's not a bad thing, but you do introduce typical cognitive biases and things like that into those sort of processes when you have that form of decision-making. So if we have a very sort of complex decision space, you know, very multidimensional or sort of complex problem, but you know, a commoditized problem, so let's say an interaction I want to make with every single customer across a reasonably sort of commoditized customer space, then being purely data-driven can give a better outcome, because I can come up with a very complex strategy that I wouldn't be able to do in this sort of environment. So, in answer to the question I posed, what does data-driven mean? Well, really it means greater automation of decision-making by using algorithms and more scientific procedures than typically be present in, say, Bob's world. So the second question, is general insurance data-driven already? Interesting question to think about. So let's think about pricing. So pricing is probably an area where, you know, we use a lot of data and a lot of modelling and what have you. So can we reasonably say that pricing is data-driven? Well, let's think about the journey that pricing's gone on. You know, a long time ago, modern birth of insurance in London, you know, insurance kind of rose out of shipping risks, and there probably wasn't that much data about what was actually going on in the market then. People knew that ships sank occasionally. And over time, natural market forces kind of arose so that, you know, bigger ships would probably pay more for their insurance than smaller ships and, you know, so on and so forth. But again, there's probably not too much data that was leading to those decisions. It was highly judgmental. Then when we look at the sort of 20th century, well, you had more sort of commoditized products. So, you know, motor's probably the best example where, you know, cars become pretty much standardized, the insurance policy becomes pretty much standardized, and you can collect a lot more data with which you can build much more rigorous models around risk, and therefore you can inform your pricing with that. So, you know, late 20th century, you know, risk cost modelling with GLMs and what have you became pretty commonplace. Later, demand-based pricing and the like and sort of price optimization became pretty commonplace. And so, you know, you can reasonably say that insurance pricing is data-driven, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, depending on the product line and the company you look at, but it's reasonable to say it's reasonably data-driven. However, there's a lot of other parts of the sales journey. So pricing is only one element of the sales journey. It's an important one, but it's only one. So this is a simplistic sales journey. And there's important and interesting decisions that happen across that sales journey. So, you know, the consideration phase, I might be thinking about what direct marketing message should I send to a customer. It's an interesting question. You know, before they get a quote, if they come on a website, we should probably think about how we should, you know, render that website. What should the page look like? What kind of messages do I want to put in front of that customer? Again, it's an interesting question. At quote time, should I give a special offer to this person or not? It's not a pricing decision. It's a more a product design sort of marketing type decision. Again, it's an interesting question. Once I've made the sale, should I send the customer a welcome pack? Should I give them a call? You know, what kind of interaction should I have with them after I've actually made the sale? If they come and endorse their policy, you know, what kind of call center script should I have for that kind of interaction? Should that vary by customer? When they come to renew, or when I'm sending out the renewal, rather, you know, what time should I send that? Should I send it a week before, a day before, a month before? Again, it's an interesting question. All of these are decisions that happen during the sales process, exactly the same as a pricing decision. But they're not really decisions that actuaries typically look at, and I'm not quite sure why. Because they're all interesting decisions. They're all spaces where data can inform the decision quite easily. And so my challenge to you people is let's branch out and actually do things other than pricing, which I know some people do, but it's still relatively rare. And the other challenge is to think about those decisions holistically. So actually, should we have the same set of goals, the same sort of framework for making the right decision? What does the word right mean? What does optimal mean for this sort of decision set? Again, if we can, as a profession, look across the whole value chain, we can potentially drive that. There are other areas in insurance companies where people are becoming more data-driven. I mean, the claims process is very similar to the sort of sales process that I just sort of illustrated. So again, it's a series of decisions which are quite commoditized, where data can help inform a superior decision, once we've defined what superior means. So again, there's a whole series of interaction points with our customers where potentially actuaries can be adding value. There's, you know, moves towards being data-driven across back office functions, so HR and the like, and a lot more sort of strategic analysis that's potentially going on in insurance companies. So in answer to the second question, is insurance data-driven? Well, kind of, in some limited places, but there's lots of growth potential. So So that's what excites me in my current role, given that the remit is essentially analytics across the whole value chain. So I have some final observations. So ethics, it's quite an important area to think about. It's a very complex area, especially when we get down to sort of personalization and, you know, optimization at that individual customer level. So important to have a general rule of thumb, which I quite like. You know, if your work was public knowledge, would you be happy about it? If the answer is no, probably shouldn't be doing it. That deals with obviously problematic sort of areas of ethics, but actually there are, in this space, some large unanticipated issues that can happen. So there was the, you know, famous case where in the US, Target were running targeted advertising, so pushing flyers out to different people with different content in the flyers, depending on who they were. Very sensible thing to do, sell more stuff as a result. Sent flyers and emails and a bunch of stuff to a teenager advertising, you know, baby stuff. Her dad wasn't too happy about it, because he didn't know that she was carrying, and yeah, that became a bit of a PR disaster at the time, just from Target's marketing, which ostensibly couldn't cause a problem, surely. So it's important to try and foresee those kind of issues and think about them in a, like a risk management type context. And again, I think actuaries can potentially add a lot of value in thinking through those problems in quite a structured way and trying to uncover problems that may exist. And really, we should familiarise ourselves, if we're not already familiar, with privacy principles that exist, that we have to abide by, and generally sort of thinking in this area, which is evolving and quite complex. And finally, sort of cultural change. Cultural change is hard. If we're going to move from sort of Bob to Betty, whatever the names were that I used, there's a natural sense of inertia in Bob, because he's operated that way for so long, it's quite hard to sort of change. And Bob might have a natural sort of fear of sort of losing control of the decision-making process that he's managed ostensibly quite effectively for a long time. And particularly where we get not so much actuaries, but more sort of so-called data scientists involved in this sort of research who are not necessarily insurance experts, there's sometimes a fear of non-experts sort of breaking the business. So it's important that to sort of cut through those sort of issues. And designing robust experiments where we're actually measuring the results in market of what happens is a good way to sort of prove value. If we're proving value, then nothing's being broken. Some people are far, far too excited. There's, you know, a lot of hype around this area. And excitement's good, we just have to make sure that we're channeling it in the right area. So if people are looking for silver bullets, that's sometimes challenging. But if we can target that excitement into something that's a viable project, that's pretty helpful. And having a mandate from senior executives is very, very important. As Ron was sort of saying earlier, you know, we have to make sure that we can actually execute things, and if you have an exec mandate, that really helps push things along, particularly where you've got cultural change as a potential barrier. So in summary, being data-driven basically means automating decision-making, removing human bias where we can, and becoming a bit more scientific. Now, in insurance companies, that's either done really, really well at certain decision points or not at all at other decision points. Depending on the company and depending on the decision point, that kind of varies. There's a big opportunity to look holistically across those decisions, across sort of customer journeys, which I don't think has necessarily been done particularly well broadly in the industry. And yeah, ethics is hard and interesting and complex, and culture is pretty much the same. So thank you very much, and look forward to Q&A.
I'll put this down to my mic. Thanks very much, Chris. Okay. Hugh Miller is the second tallest actuary at Taylor Fry, good to know, where he's worked for the past 10 years. During that time, he has been involved in a wide variety of projects across general insurance. With a PhD in statistics, he has a particular interest in improved techniques for modelling in pricing and reserving work. He has also been applying these skills more broadly, most recently in customer loyalty and social sector welfare modelling. Later on, we'll test whether Chris or Hugh is the tallest actuary in this room. And please welcome Hugh.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. So I'm talking today about software and tools, which is a little bit worrying because any particular piece of software or tool that I mentioned today, I could easily ramble on about for an hour. So sort of condensing all of that down to lots of different things in 20 minutes is quite hard. But I was slightly reassured by the name of the conference, which is GI Glimpse. So Glimpse, of course, we can define as a momentary or cursory view. So I'm planning to give you a momentary and cursory view of software and tools today. So why talk about software and tools? And the simple answer is it's because what a lot of us use a lot of the time. So it fundamentally determines what we can do full stop, and it fundamentally determines how much we can get done in a day. So it's worth thinking about, and it's worth recognising that this is something that's always going to evolve and improve. So that picture there is the first mass-produced computer in the world, the IBM 650. So you can see it there in all its glory and with fashion trends at the time. So this really was a modern marvel when it was sort of produced, and you could do things that you could never done before. It had kilobytes of memory that you could sort of code by hand, and if you owned 10 of them, you could probably store my ringtone. And the people who could program these things were heroes because they could really automate bits of their business that they never could before. That said, if you told them to fit a GLM to the customer data to improve their pricing process, well, they'd say, well, we don't have a table of customer data, we couldn't fit it in our computer, and GLMs haven't been invented yet, and we wouldn't know what to do with that, even if we had it. So this is sort of the late 50s, and of course things have changed a lot since then. Interestingly, I think AMP bought one of these, and that was the second computer used in the commercial sector in Australia. So bonus points if you can guess who the first company was, not AMP. So in terms of what I'll talk about, I sort of have this in the back of my mind that I'm talking about people who do actuarial analysis to support general insurance. So the types of functions I'm thinking of are pricing, other customer models, sort of demand and take up and stuff like that, statistical case estimation perhaps, and maybe monitoring as well. I guess reserving, although those models tend to be a little bit different to everything else. I've talked on this subject a couple of times before. Today's talk will be a little bit different, just to keep things fresh. I guess that's why I was invited to talk. In the words of one anonymous soul, we were talking about tools and thought of you. So I'm going to talk about sort of four big categories: hardware, software, algorithms, and communication tools. And I'm going to put each of them on a spectrum, mainly because I like colour. So I'm going to start off with hardware. So our spectrum for hardware ranges from the kickable to the less kickable. So you'd all be familiar with a desktop, laptop environment. So you have a CPU that hides inside the desktop. You submit a process, the CPU does its thing and gives you an answer back. So that's sort of the simplest and easiest world to live in. But the world is evolving. So one thing we can point out is the rise of graphics cards, and I'll talk about that again on the next slide. Another thing that you'd almost all be familiar with is the idea of an internal shared server. So instead of running things locally on your computer, you'd have a big SAS server or something else server with 16 cores that sits somewhere, monitored by the IT admins so they can randomly boot you off when your process is almost completed. And that's a good way of sort of maintaining overall integrity and data sharing and security and those sorts of things. So IT administrators love those things. No one else loves those things. And on the right is sort of some of the more modern developments. So cluster computing is a useful thing. So if you need to take the average of a billion numbers, it can take a long time. So an obvious thing to do is to chop it up into 10 million number blocks, take the average of each of them, and distribute that across 100 computers, and you can do your average 100 times faster. So that's effectively what cluster computing is about. And that's something that is a very important option when you've got problems at that scale. And at the far right is sort of the cloud equivalent of that. So that's the Amazons and the Microsoft Azures of the world, where you can actually sort of push your cluster computing or just your everyday computing into the cloud. It's a different way of doing business, and the main attraction, I guess, is it's flexible and scalable. So if you're a tech startup like Uber and you don't want to sort of spend lots on hardware up front, You can just put it all in the cloud, and they do. So they run all their back end on Amazon or Azure, I forget which one. So that's sort of the broad spectrum of hardware choices. And basically, the problem you're working on will often dictate what the natural solution is. The main comment I want to make, though, is that hardware is always getting better. So you've probably heard of Moore's Law, which refers to the density of transistors on chips. Its cousin is Cooney's Law, which basically says that the computational power efficiency, so the number of processes you can do per unit of electricity, doubles every 1.5 years. And so that law seems to have held true for a number of decades now. And there's a chart there that I borrowed from The Economist. So that's basically saying that it will continue to get better. It's interesting to note that the last 5 years of that chart aren't there. And the mantle has sort of passed from CPUs to GPUs in terms of the inheritance of Cooney's law. So a lot of the processing now done by the big data companies has moved from a traditional CPU, which sort of is a powerful processor, but you've only got a few of them, to graphics cards, so GPUs, where you have lots of hundreds of little processors that are weaker, but collectively do the job better and more power efficiently in this case. The picture on the right there is CSIRO's supercomputer. So they've invested in graphics cards for a lot of their work. They claim to have one of the largest Windows supercomputers in the world, which I think says more about the popularity of Windows as a supercomputing platform more than anything else, but there it is. So moving on to software choices. So I basically got an index here between point and click sort of software, so easy to use versus hardcore ways that you use that you can sort of impress people on the street. The format has gone a little bit off there. At the bottom there, but we sort of start with the point-click software, so I love Excel, it's wonderful, but it's not the right way to structure your data analysis projects for a variety of reasons, once you're sort of interested in repeating or doing large data sets. To the right of that, we have the statistical languages. So we have SAS is probably the most prevalent in the GI industry, but there are other options there too, so Stata is SPSS, R, so R is the free open source one, which is gaining in popularity. And then beyond statistical, we have the database languages. So typically these are less popular for the data science type applications, but it's something you'll routinely have to interact with. So SQL is the most common sort of database you tend to see, and you might have to get the data out and do some work and get the data back in again. But there are in-database operations you can do, and you can do analytics in database, of course, as well. So beyond that, we have what the real programming languages, so the Pythons, the Javas, C++, and the various flavors of C and Go is a Google language, which is good for parallelizing things. So that seems to be increasing in popularity rather than decreasing. So all these things, of course, you can build real software with those languages, but they're also very important for scientific and statistical computing. And certainly if you go somewhere like Kaggle, where there are lots of data mining competitions, most of the scripts you see for people competing are either R scripts, so using R, or Python scripts. So those seem to be the two main languages that are flourishing at the moment for machine learning and data science. And at the very far end, you've got the extensions. So if you're doing cluster computing or working in the cloud, typically you need a software language that interacts with whatever the hardware is, so your Hadoops or your graphics cards, and there tend to be languages to do that. So to interact with NVIDIA graphics cards, there's a language called CUDA, which is a variant of C, and similarly for Hadoop, it's usually extensions to existing languages, but sometimes there are bespoke languages as well that you can learn. So that's software. In terms of comparing software, basically the origins of a software, where it comes from, I usually dictate the types of things it's good at. So the chart on the top right shows the time taken to do some sort of data manipulation operations. You can see that SQL is very slow because it's not really designed for aggregate data manipulation. It's designed for sort of modifying one record at a time. And so it was very slow. This analysis is a year or two old now. Python, by contrast, is a low-level programming language, so it should be fast, and it is fast. And everything else sits in between. interestingly, are in SaaS because they have quite different paradigms in how they think about data, are actually sort of quite good at different things. So R, for instance, is good at sorting and less good at merging compared to SaaS. The chart on the bottom right there is sort of GLM fit times, so how long it takes to fit a regression model. I'm not sure there's a huge amount to take away from that, except that you shouldn't use SPSS, and that there is usually value in optimizing what you do. So I've got there sort of an R default and a SAS default, as well as a SAS best and an R best, and that's saying that if you do sort of think about your problem, sort of figure out how to fine-tune it or make it as fast as you can, usually there's value to be gained. The table there sort of shows various sort of statistical functions, things you might want to be able to do in a statistical or machine learning package. The main comment there is that most software has filled out the feature base quite a lot over the past few years. So it used to be the case that if you wanted to do A, B, and C, you'd recommend software X, and if you wanted to do D, E, and F, you'd do software Y. That's no longer the case, although I guess in the case of SaaS, they sort of have most of the features, but you tend to pay in tiers, both physical tiers and tiers with an A. I don't have too much more to say on that slide. In terms of other developments that are interesting right now, Microsoft is going hard in the open source direction. So one thing they've done recently is they bought Revolution Analytics, which is an R provider. So I think that the strategy is they're integrating R into various bits of their service, including databases. In terms of database software itself, that's also developing. So the NoSQL movement is all about how can we store databases in a non-relational way, so away from traditional relational databases, to allow for the fact that we've got big data and sort of how better to structure it. And also the thing that seems to be happening now is the rise of Python as a statistical programming language itself. Is something that people didn't pick 10 years ago, but seems to be a thing, and certainly sort of in some ways edging out R in terms of the number of packages that people want to support. So that's software. The next I wanted to talk about is algorithms. So by algorithms, I'm going to talk about predictive learning. So if you want to understand a response variable like claim size, how can you sort of understand that with the other information you've got about a customer or a car or something else? So again, this is something that has evolved a lot over time. The grey bar at the bottom again isn't quite right, apologies. So back in the good old days, you basically sort of maybe look at a one-way table or sort of hand-pick some relativities, and that would be what you did for predictive modelling. I did note that when I went through the Part 1 syllabus, I did the UK exams, there was actually a section on how to hand-smooth the line, literally by drawing it by hand. I've never had the chance to put it on my CV, but I hope to one day. So beyond that, we sort of move on to the classical approaches. So they're the actuarial credibility, the GLMs and regression models that you'd all be, most of you would be fairly familiar with. And so they sort of developed in the 70s and 80s and are a good way to understand multivariate data, and so very popular with good reason. Moving past that is the semi-modern approaches, sort of late 80s, 90s, so generalized additive models and decision trees. So these are the types of models where you just start by pressing go and see what happens. And so they actually often did reasonable work, and you can get insights semi-automatically or automatically in some cases. That sort of then got compounded in the modern world. So the modern techniques such as neural nets support vector machines, generalized boosted machines. Typically they use decision trees and sort of lots of little ones to produce a final model. And penalized regression. These are all sort of techniques developed in the late 90s, or neural nets were earlier, in the 90s and noughties. And their reason for being is sort of a highly accurate but more complex model. And so there are contexts in which you want to build those things and they can do them quickly. And so that's sort of where machine learning was at for a long time. Deep learning seems to be a new thing. So it's only 5 years old. It's relatively immature. It's sort of an enhancement of neural nets is one way of thinking of it. It has made huge progress in some predictive modelling problems that were previously quite hard, and everyone is very excited about it. It makes probably less of a difference in the insurance space, but certainly if you're interested in voice recognition or image recognition or even sort of chatbots and things like that, deep learning has actually sort of done more in 5 years than the previous 10. It really is quite amazing. So there are lots of developments in algorithms as well. So there's still lots of mileage in regression frameworks. So people like the idea of sort of controllable models that are smooth and you can understand and explain to people and might explain to 95% of your signal. And that's why they are and remain popular. Deep learning has been going open source, so all the tech companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft and Baidu have been open sourcing their deep learning technology and sort of putting it out there in the hope that people would sort of pick it up. The other thing that's been good about algorithms is sort of the meta-algorithms, that people are much more aware of how to do this modelling properly. So having good validation, testing things, sort of building the experimental design around that has all been quite good and encouraging, I think. And there's always hard work on the implementation side. So in some sense, the algorithms are easy. It's what you do with it and how you implement that at the end, which can be the challenge. So the fourth category I wanted to talk about was communication styles. So back in the good old days, you'd start with a table and say, these are the results, and you present them in a table. If you were worried that your manager didn't like numbers, you present a chart. And if you're on having a good day and had some spare time, you change the colours in the chart so they matched your company logo. So that's where it sat at for quite a long time. And I think the improved interactivity of the web is something that sort of kick-started a revolution that we've seen now in communication tools. So web dashboards and JavaScript has allowed the websites to be very interactive, and lots of companies will have internal web dashboards and sort of ways of viewing results using web technologies. But that in turn has sort of generated this new industry of visualization software. So Tableau is probably the most popular one of that list, but basically every big company has a visualization software, and I'll try and sell that. And that the whole premise is that you can sort of have the data living in the background, and then you can interact with it. So you can still see your charts and your tables and your maps. But if you want to see it on a specific cohort, or you want to sort of see what happens if you do scenario X, Y, Z, you can all sort of click through and the results are sort of presented to you in real time. So that's a really cool thing, and it's sort of quite exciting. So if I had infinite time, I'd follow that link to sort of quite a nice Tableau example. If you haven't come across visualization software before, you should go to that link, or you should sort of look for some of the public galleries to get a sense for what they can do, or of course call your nearest actuarial consultant to demonstrate their product. So that's been quite exciting. It comes with a caveat, of course, which is that the analyst can't just sort of put it in the visualization and give it to the manager and expect that to be in the end of the process. So the generation of insights and important information that comes out of a set of results still has to be done somewhere. And often it's a mistake to assume that the manager will just automatically sit there for an hour with the visualization and do it themselves. So that work still remains to be done. In terms of how communication is changing at the moment, one thing that I quite like is that mapping has gotten a lot easier. So even, I'm sort of thinking 8 years ago, somebody asked me to produce a map, and the way you did it was you got a clunky piece of software and you sort of figured out exactly the right format to get the data into it, and then it would sort of take a while to render, and eventually you get something that you could take a screenshot of and put in the presentation. So that map there is average incomes in Sydney by statistical areas. I think from the point of starting to download the data to pasting that in PowerPoint was less than 3 minutes. And sort of any piece of software tends to tout its ability to put maps in places, and so that's been a nice thing. That's probably more a personal hobby horse from that grueling experience of having to produce maps back in the old world. We've also made quite a lot of progress in terms of how we explain black box models. So because models are getting more complex, the way in which we sort of identify important variables, explain how they do it, understand interactions between variables, has had to develop as well, because sort of that stuff we can't just read from the GRM specification, for instance. And so lots of techniques have been developed to do that, and I think we're getting better at that. And another thing that's important that has sort of been pleasing, I think, is that the communication of model uncertainty, I think, is getting better as well. So all models carry uncertainty, of course, and the way in which you can communicate that and sort of render that is good. So thank you very much. So they're the sort of four categories I talked through. I guess in terms of general trends, then hardware is getting a little bit more agnostic. You can do it wherever you want, as long as sort of your problem gets done in a reasonable amount of time. I can imagine Nirvana maybe in 20 years' time, where you start a process on your laptop, realize it's taking a long time, and it sort of magically gets done in the cloud. Probably never get there, but we'll see. Software has a trend towards lower level languages, so the people who can do Python and things like that will probably be the winners in the long term. And standardization of data structures will probably sort of help that process a little bit. Algorithms will continue to get more and more automatic until the robots defeat us all. And communication has gotten better despite the fact that I've given you a completely boring PowerPoint presentation today. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Hugh. And I have to admit to you, very recently producing charts in my company colours. Next up we have Chow Chow, who advises clients in the insurance industry on issues ranging from forecasting, monitoring, data collection, experience analysis, reinsurance, capital and return to work. Chow has recently explored ways to combine actuarial analytics with behavioural economics to deliver better return to work outcomes to workers' compensation claimants. Over the years, Chow has also maintained a keen interest in socially relevant research and discussions, especially on longevity insurance. Chow graduated from the University of New South Wales with first class honours in actuarial studies. Chow is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries and a chartered enterprise risk actuary. As a young actuary, he also actively volunteers at the Institute, most recently on council, focusing on issues such as education and new practice areas. Please welcome Chow.
Hello everyone, thank you for the opportunity to present here. You've heard from Hugh and Chris on data analytics, so I'm going to give you an example of how something a bit different can be done in general insurance in terms of data analytics. So this is something that you may not have thought of in your everyday life. It's behavioural economics. And why do we use behavioural economics? Well, because we're human. Now, being human, we make decisions and choices not necessarily based on logic or information or, you know, rational thinking. So here are some examples. Which insurer should I insure with? Now, my mother insures with Amy. However, if you go on the websites of QBE and NRMA, they'll give you cheaper prices. So why does my mother still insure with Amy? For that particular vehicle, of course. Another insurance example. Now, workers' compensation claimant. Now, my insurer has told me that I need to visit this doctor, chiropractor or a physiotherapist or whatever, in order to get me to return to work. Now, I know that that's a win-win situation. If I go to see that doctor, I will return to work much faster and it will save my insurance company a bit of money as well. But why do I not visit that doctor, despite the fact that I'm, you know, visiting doctors would make my life easier as an injured person? Well, why should I return to work at all? Because my next door pod neighbour, Sam, took a whole month for a little ankle sprain. Why should I return to work next week? I'm losing out, aren't I? But, you know, it's irrational, right? If we return to work next week, we get more job satisfaction and we get paid more money because we're off workers' comp. And where should I go for dinner? Should I go to KFC? Should I go to McDonald's? Should I go to Hungry Jack's? Now, lots of people do. A lot of people in my family go to Hungry Jack's and KFC. Why do we do that? Now, they well know that by eating junk food will make your life much more difficult later on. But why do we still eat food that's not healthy? You know, people make these choices. You know, where should I send my kids to school? You know, say for example, I'm a Chinese person. And my family would like to send people to schools that offer Chinese. Now, is that really a good thing for them to do? Now, that school may not have very good you know, mathematics teachers or science teachers. It's probably just teaching people Chinese. You know, is that really what we want? Well, not really. We want our kids to have a very good education all around, not just in Chinese. And recently you've heard the High Court case on ANZ and people not paying their bills on time. Now, these people, they're perfectly aware that by not paying their credit card bills on time, they're going to get a $20 fee. And yet, you have all these people not paying their credit cards on time very, very regularly, month after month. Now, why do people do that? And then they come back and they go and have a class action against ANZ. I'm not making a value judgment here. I'm just saying, you know, these are the decisions that people make. Now, are they always rational? Probably not. And so we actually need a new approach. So why do we need a new approach? Because companies, insurance companies or otherwise, companies and organizations continue to rely on rational thinking. They design processes and they invest in solutions designed for the rational person. And no wonder some of them continue to fail short. I'll give you some examples. Now, who can think of what this picture is telling? Now, you see this picture all the time these days, in the recent few weeks. Now, you know, you see people playing Pokemon Go on the highway, you know, trying to catch them all and crashing their cars, donating their lives to this wonderful game. Why do people do that? You know, because we follow others, because other people are doing it. You know, my friend John is doing it. You know, my friend Anna is doing it. So I'm going to do it because this is in fashion. If something's in fashion, I'm going to do it. You know, if taking a long time to return to work is in fashion, I'm going to do that. Because we follow others, you know, despite the fact that there's a rational choice out there, I'm not going to do it, I'm going to follow others. Here's another example. Now, for those of you using iPhone, now iOS or whatever you call it, 9.3 or something just came out last week. And as part of the process of installing that on your own iPhone, you have to agree to these terms and conditions. You know, several pages long, and you have to click on several links to read the whole document. How many people actually bother to read it? Do we just go, yep, agree? Now, do you know what you've actually agreed to? You've agreed to Apple using your information, such as language, location, you know, what model of the phone you use, etc., to understand customer behavior. Now, that's in the fine print. How many of us actually read that? Very, very few. Why don't we read it, despite the fact that it's got a tangible impact on our lives? And maybe we don't agree with everything that's contained in that thing. Why do we do that? Because there's too much information. Too much information. We don't have time. We can't be bothered. Same thing with workers' comp. Now, this is an example letter that one of my colleagues received after she injured herself at work. Now, this is the letter that she got. Now, exactly what she's required to do, it's extremely unclear. Now, the letter starts off with legislation, and then legislation, and then legislation, and then comes the decision. If you don't give us this information by this date, we're not going to pay you. Now, what's that going to induce my colleague to do? My colleague's going to be induced to absolutely do nothing about this because this is too much information. I haven't got the time. I don't understand what this is about. I'll just go, yep, agree. But there's no agree button. You actually had to do something, right? Now, she didn't know. Lots of people don't know. And that's why you see that with a lot of companies, including insurance companies, you have customers who make choices that are irrational. There's a win-win situation out there, but they're just not seeing it. Now, again, I'm a Chinese person. Now, that's a very familiar picture you'll see in supermarkets these days. Now, baby formula. Now, this is Coles. Each customer is only allowed four tins or whatever, three tins of baby powder. Milk powder. Why is that? Why do we do that? Because we take shortcuts. Now, I see my friends and my parents' friends buying baby formula, sending them to our other friends and relatives in China. Do we actually need baby powder? Well, some people do, some people don't. Do I need baby powder? I probably don't. And yet I buy it. Why? Because it must be good. Yeah, 3 tins per customer. It must be good. If it's not good, why are people trying to get it? Why do people buy this all the time? And it's not, they don't go to the supermarket and buy one or two, they buy 10. So that's why there's a limit of 3 per customer. So each time I go to the supermarket, I max myself out three cans of baby powder. Yeah, and I send them back to China, to my family and to my friends. Do I actually need that much powder? I don't know. I just do it. Yeah? People take shortcuts. We just do it. Now, that's a piece of legislation that everyone claiming workers' comp will see. You get 12 weeks of provisional liability until your claim can be assessed further, until you have to do something about it, you have to return to work or see a doctor or whatever. How are you going to react to that? Well, 12 weeks. How long do I actually need to take to go back to work? I don't know. That's irrelevant. But this letter, my insurer is telling me I have 12 weeks. So it looks like my condition usually takes 12 weeks. Yeah? So I'll just max it out. I'll max out my 12 weeks. Yeah? And I'll mentally adjust to the 12 weeks, you know? On the one hand, I could have gone to a doctor, I could have done this, I could have done that, I could have returned to work in 6 weeks. And yet, because mentally I'm thinking, oh, there's no way I can return to work in 6 weeks. If I could return to work in 6 weeks, why is my insurer telling me that they're going to pay me for 12 weeks until I provide further information? Because I actually need to take 12 weeks. Well, do I really need to take that much time? Here's another interesting example. And by the way, some of this material is repeated from previous presentation I've given at previous seminars. So some of this material may look familiar to you. Now, here's an example. The Economist a few years ago was trying to get people to subscribe to the online version of the magazine. Now, back in the day, 68% of their customers subscribed to this economist.com, and they want more people to do this online thing plus print, so a more comprehensive offering of their products so that they can earn more money and get more profit. Now, 32% of people paid $125, 68% of people paid $59. So what did they do? Well, they put another option out there saying, well, you can just get the print for $125. Now, people saw that. They were like, well, if I could get both print and web for $125, why would I go and just get print for $125? Yeah? But that provides an anchor for people to make their decisions. Yeah? Because people are like, oh, right, So the online component is actually worth nothing, yeah? It's the print component that's worth all the money. So the online component is virtually free. So why would I pay for $59 just to get the online? Right? It's a waste of money because it's free. I'll just go print and web for $125. And unsurprisingly, no one paid $125 just to get print. They paid $125 to get both print and web. And web subscriptions shot up by quite substantially. And at the same time, people got the print subscription as well. So here you go. So why do we do this? Why do we do this? Because organizations that miss behavioral patterns and continue to invest in rational models will continue to fail short. That's an opportunity for actuaries, because customer behavior is a very important and interesting area for everyone to make a difference, including actuaries. Now, we heard from Chris that now data analysis is being used or going to be used across the value chain. Now, this is not pricing. Workers' comp is not just about pricing. Workers' comp is also about how to improve outcomes, both well-being outcomes and financial outcomes. And part of that is human behaviour. So how do we actually do that? Well, here's where actuaries come in. All of that stuff I talked to you about earlier, that's all in here. You've got timing, framing, social and cues and so on, friction and complexity. This is where people can be nudged, or processes can be designed utilizing predictable, irrational behavior. But that's not the whole story. You've got to understand who to nudge and where to nudge. So here's the analysis to understand how people are irrational, predictably irrational. Yeah? And at the end, we've also heard Chris saying we've got to run experiments. That's how we run data analysis. We've got to run some experiments and see whether it's actually worked. I'll give you some examples of how we do that component, the analysis component, to see where to nudge and who to nudge. One of the most classic examples, it's not there, is to run a regression model. You run a regression model, you see what causes people to do what. What group of customers will, you know, so if you think about it, return to work, here's an example. You've got a bunch of people who are very, very severely injured. It doesn't matter what you do, they're not going to return to work because they can't. They just can't because they're very severely injured. And then you've got a group of people who are naturally motivated. I saw a news article a few years ago of a Taronga Zoo elephant handler returned to work in record time. So you've got a bunch of people who, it doesn't matter what you throw at them, they're naturally motivated to reach that outcome. Behavioural economics is not going to do anything without those people. But behavioural economics is going to influence people who want to achieve a certain outcome, but they don't know how to because their irrational behaviour has overtaken their thinking. So we can do some regression to find out who those people are, what characteristics they hold, or we can use some of the new models and tools that Hugh talked about and use trees. We use trees to understand decision trees, yeah? Understand who those people are. Or we can use a bit of cluster analysis to understand who those people are. What characteristics do they have? Who do we need to nudge? So that's where attributes come in. Data. Data-driven thinking. Data-driven process. Then you go and do your nudge. But you've got to find out whether it's actually worked. As Chris said, you can't just have a bunch of people sitting around the table deciding what to do. You've got to have data-driven, evidence-driven decision-making. So, for example, in this example, how do I know this has worked? You've got to run an experiment, yeah? Now, maybe they had another option here. It didn't work out. That's why it didn't make their way to its presentation. This presentation is what worked. This worked. How do we know this worked? You've got to have a controlled environment to test your idea, to test your solution, to test your intervention, and see that this has actually worked. And so I'll give you some examples of how we did that in real life. At PwC, we have a really ugly old office and people don't use stairs. And we want people to use stairs because we don't want the lifts to jam up. We want people to have better physical exercise at work. And so as part of our nudge of doing that, we put some footprints and some posters around the office to get people to use stairs. And just by doing that, that's a behavioural nudge, yeah? So if you go into a meeting on another floor, you're not going to think, oh, am I going to catch the lift or am I going to use the stairs? I'm going to rely on my irrational, intuitive thinking. And it turned out that by running that experiment, we found out that by just simply having these footprints and some posters around the place, we increased stair usage by 40%. Between two particular floors. Now, these are levels 6 and 7. They're the management consultants. They live on levels 6 and 7. And, you know, something simple as that How do we know it's worked? Because we ran an experiment. And as part of the same experiment, we also found that by using posters alone, it had no effect on people's behaviour, and by using footprints alone, it had no effect on people's behaviour. Rather curious, exactly why, we don't understand. We don't need to, because we know that this has worked. This worked. We rolled it out to every single floor. People started using stairs more often. Here's another example of return to work. How many people have returned to work after how long? Now, there was some analysis done up front, some behavioural nudge done in the middle. Ran an experiment. We found that the bunch of people who were given the behavioural nudge returned to work much faster. Now, for those of you who may have seen this graph somewhere else, it looked like that, but it's the same graph, because that graph we don't have to copyright to. Whereas that, so here you go, that's the blue and that's the red. So the red is the group that we nudge, and the blue is the group we didn't nudge. Return to work much faster. So hopefully this has given you a glimpse of how behavioural economics operates in practice and how actuaries can make a difference. If you would like further information, there are some very good books. Predictably Irrational, that's a very good book, and Nudge, that's also a very good book by Sunstein. It's sort of the gold standard book in behavioural economics. So if you would like more information, please read these books. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chow. If our speakers could please come up and sit in the chairs over there to respond to questions. I would like to ask the first question again. Chris, we've had an interesting talk from Chow about behavioural economics. I'd be interested in your role. Your presentation talked a lot about data-driven decisions and actually eliminating the human component, and that might be you could make superior decisions doing that. How do you meld the two things? Because clearly there is some scope for understanding human behaviour. How is that done in your role without giving away any information that we shouldn't have?
Yep. Okay. Look, it's a good question. I think it's not one or the other. In my view, the behavioural economics angle is very important in sort of designing the intervention that you might put in market. It's a really good angle to have in, I guess, your design thinking. In terms of the actual measurement and execution, obviously you've got to do that in a really robust way, but I think it's very complementary.
So do you actually do any of that in your work?
I mean, my team actually generally is just doing the analysis element, but would absolutely be involved in the design phase to make sure that it's going to be measured robustly and sort of help with the thinking. But we have, you know, other people around the company that do a lot of design work, which absolutely leverages those sort of things. So, I mean, the other angle is sort of what I touched on, which is really, you know, understanding human bias and decision making. So actually, when you're convincing people to move towards a more data-driven paradigm, you've got to be aware of the current biases that might exist in current decision making and try and sort of draw them out if you can with historic data. That's sometimes quite powerful.
Questions from the floor?
Hi, I'm Maggie from EY. So I've got a question for either of you. So I've mainly worked in the traditional actuarial area. Not that I don't like my job, but just in case if I want to get into the non-traditional area, what sort of skill set do you think we'll need to develop? And especially if we're competing against statisticians and mathematicians to get into the digital or data-driven space, what advantages or disadvantages do we have?
I'll go very quickly and say the main skill you need is curiosity. So give it a go and be genuinely curious about problems that might be solved, and you'll solve them. I mean, we're not stupid people. We can solve a lot of problems, but
we narrow our frame to traditional areas, and that's a bit of a shame. So I would encourage everyone to go out and solve new problems, because you can do it.
I guess I'll add to that that, I mean, the Institute is asking the same question, so there's a data analytics working group that all three of us have sat on at various points in time. It's exactly that. So the point is the actuarial skill set is good because it's a mix of business as well as computers a little bit and the statistics and technical side. So it actually is quite well positioned, but you are competing against every man and his dog and the dog's pet as well. So it can be quite competitive, and the easiest way to branch out is to find a job that lets you do that. So if you want a job at Taylor Fry.
Taylor Fry isn't a sponsor of this event.
Correct.
Chow, do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I think, so if you think about all of the presentations, it's about the tools that we can use. So we have to get ourselves technically on the same level. So, for example, can you use Python? Can you use R? You know, can you fit a, you know, random tree or a random forest? Or can you, you know, do a lot of the things that we didn't used to do? You know, if you just did the GLM for the, you know, entirety of your career, you're probably not going to be able to compete. Now, secondly, once you've got to that level, I think the strength of our actual profession is our business knowledge and industry knowledge. And so, for example, workers' comp is sort of my and my company's area of, you know, expertise and strength. So we didn't apply this behavioural economics nudge to the economist. We did it for workers' comp. So you've got to pick your industry, pick your right areas. And of course, there's going to be other, you know, data scientists out there doing other things. So 30 years ago, they didn't move to general insurance. Actuaries did. Got the industry knowledge to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Brennan, also from EY. A question on the first presentation. You talked about culture as being a bit of a barrier to the full embedment of data-driven decision-making. Are there any other barriers that you see, whether real or perceived, and are there any ways to overcome those?
Oh, tons, but they can all be overcome. So, it really depends on the specific thing that you're trying to do. The barriers will always be slightly different, but, technology can sometimes be a barrier. So, for instance, if your decision has to be embedded in a core system that sort of pings a message up on someone's screen, or, you know, if it's a website that's going to interact with your customer in a certain way, the technology's got to be sort of built to enable that. So actually doing the analysis is sort of this much of the work. The actual technology build is an important part as well. So depending on what you're looking at doing, that could potentially be a barrier. As I said, sort of culture can be a barrier depending on what you're looking at. Bias from previous decisions can be a barrier. So you might find yourself sort of challenging things that have always been done because that's sort of the known truth. But as I sort of said, the known truth might be because, you know, Bob's done it a certain way for 30 years because he thinks he made the right decision. Well, maybe he didn't. So we need to sort of start challenging almost everything and making sure it's robustly measured. So the barriers are always different. It's just important to be aware that they will exist and sort of tackle them head on.
I found the concept that not all people are rational quite interesting. I kind of agree with that. I just wanted a bit more sort of your insights. What do you think are the most effective channels? Like you mentioned timing, frames, social and cues, but sort of in your experience, what's the most effective?
I think it depends on the situation. It depends on the client that we're working with. And their customers, because different people respond to different things, yeah? But I'll give you an example of that particular exercise. So we didn't run that within PwC. There was a government department behavioural insights unit that ran some of the interventions. I think one of the things that they did was they changed the letters up. So instead of having all that legislation here, there, there and there, you know, on the first two pages, and decision right in the middle, and what you had to do down at the end, they just had a letter saying you have to do this. So you need to send us, you know, your phone number on the first page. So getting rid of that friction, getting rid of that complexity, will actually help people to make better decisions. So that's one example.
Yeah. So I'm a workers' comp claimant, and you know, I'm looked at the letter and something says 12 weeks for me to return to work. How do we reduce that?
Yeah, so an example there is, I think, again, to that example, they changed it to, on average, people with your mechanism of injury took 5 weeks to recover.
Okay.
And they put the legislation later on at the end, so that you're not anchored to the idea of 12 weeks, and you're anchored to the idea of 5 weeks.
Do they need to put a number on it all?
Yes and no. So if you want to anchor people to something realistic, so get their brains thinking, yeah, you need to put an anchor there. So some of the other guys at my company, we ran a trial for a donations program for a church or something. And that church basically gave people a lot of anchors. So when you get a donations sheet, right, you get $5, $10, $20, $25. By simply changing the anchors we provided people, we increased the level of donations by a lot.
Drop the $5 one.
That's right. So if you go 5, 10, 20, 25, now people are like, oh, you know, I'm probably going to give $10, because most people give between, you know, $10 and $25. And by simply putting another box there saying $500, now people not, you know, the majority of people not going to give you $500. We got a lot more people taking the $25 box.
Thank you.
Just on the concept of complexity, so Hugh, you talked about tools and software. How complex is too complex in terms of the outcomes that you achieve, like in terms of will you end up with volatility in your results or in your premiums?
So the more complex the model, the more opportunity there is for something weird to happen. So that's without question. So that means a couple of things. Firstly, if you do have a weird niche that comes out low in a pricing model, say, you'll actually be able to spot the accumulation of that niche. In some ways, you'll be self-correcting. So if you've accidentally mispriced Porsches driven by people who like shouting, eventually the claim experience of Porsches who have people who like shouting will sort of rectify that. It does mean that the tools you've got for monitoring need to be better, typically, and that the interactive and the hotspot detection stuff you can do nowadays helps address that.
I guess with the data-driven decision-making, how much is data, the quality of data, the availability of data, still an issue in limiting moving in that direction? Say, for example, with long-tail GI classes, you know, low claim frequencies, really skewed size distributions, and you're trying to investigate particular problems or questions. How limited are you, and are those barriers being overcome?
Well, I think that's kind of two separate questions, and maybe I'll answer them both separately. So the second thing you were talking about was sort of low volumes and what have you. I mean, volume is always a problem. So if you're dealing with, you know, CDP or something with a really low claim frequency and you're trying to predict claims, that's kind of hard if you don't have, you know, a big book of business. And, you know, if you're trying to look at thousands of explanatory variables, I mean, you're probably going to have fewer claims than explanatory variables. That's going to make things a bit tough. It's hard if your volumes are not big, and that sort of restricts your ability to, you know, look at things sometimes. I mean, the long tail sort of classes are interesting as well, because you've got a long time before the sort of signal becomes visible in some decisions, not in all. So, I mean, if I'm looking at sales is quick, right? I know when I've sold something. But if I'm looking at claims, and I don't know if a claim's reported for, you know, 5 or 6 years, that's problematic. If I'm trying to sort of continuously optimise the decision, that's just not possible, right? So you either have to think about sort of cues that you're going to observe, you know, more quickly and try and look towards those as a proxy, or give up. Yeah, it depends.
I was actually going to ask a question very similar to that. So I did have another one for you, Hugh, actually. With all those different types of software you mentioned, if you don't use those as part of your job and you don't really have access to them, what's sort of a good way to get skilled up in those sort of things?
Yeah, a couple of answers. I guess the first comment is that learning your second programming language is always easier than learning your first. So a lot of the things that you already know will transfer easily. There are lots of things out there, like if you Google free Python course, you'll find lots of free Python course. The Institute's trying to support members to do that as well. So there's a data analytics seminar coming up where sort of part of that will be a tutorial in R to try and teach people who are interested. And I had a third point, but it's gone.
I'll add a third point, which is just give it a go.
Yeah.
I think people agonise about this stuff for far too long, and they'll spend months agonising about how to do something and not do it, whereas, you know, if you spend half an hour a day on your train journey home trying to teach yourself how to do something, that adds up to a lot of hours, right? And you can learn something pretty quickly without agonising over it. So just give it a go. If it's not working, give something else a go.
I'll re-mention Kaggle, which is an online website. So that actually gives you data and a challenge to work on. And often that's a good way to sort of motivate yourself to do it. Otherwise, sort of going through a tutorial can sometimes be a little bit dry.
Now, Hugh, there's a website that you can do free courses, a lot of free courses, isn't there? A lot on data analytics. What's that website?
So there's Coursera, there's edX. So there's a few of them nowadays. Udacity are three quite popular websites. Again, sort of your Googling would probably be better than my memory.
Chao, you talked about when you did that work for a workers' comp, you obviously work with some people with other skills. That have some background in behavioural economics. You know, you may have that, but obviously most of us don't have that. So if we were going to move away from insurance, would actuaries have an opportunity to work in the sort of behavioural area?
Yeah, I think so too. Depends on, you know, the company you're in and the sort of, again, the expertise of your, if you're a consultancy, you know, the expertise of your consultancy, the industries in which you usually play. And if you're an insurance company, of course, you know, in insurance, you'll apply that in an insurance context. But absolutely, we definitely need to work with these other people. So, for example, behavior economists, psychologists, and people experts. And they will do a lot of the work around exactly how to, you know, nudge people. You know, for example, what you put on the letter, how do you get people to react to a certain cue towards a certain outcome. And so it's definitely a multi-step approach. And if you look at that chart that I had earlier on, you've got analysis, then you've got intervention, and then you've got measurement. Yeah. And so every profession has a role to play there.
What?
Yep, that was it. You had it later on. Don't worry about it.
Do we have any other questions? It's been very interesting.
Hugh, you talked about, I think one of your graphs had a spectrum of a complexity of different algorithms. And on the other hand, you have the more visibility that the GLM is in credibility theory. And on the other side, you have like neural network and more sort of machine type learning techniques. Because I'm in an advisory sort of working environment. Do you find that as a barrier that these techniques are less visible and hence it's sort of a bit difficult that you can bring to your client and say, oh, this is the way we do it, but then we can't really show you because...
Yeah, so in the communication side, I think we've made advances that allow us to communicate complex models well. Yeah. So I guess the point is with a complex model, there's still an age curve hiding in there and a sum insured curve and all that sort of stuff. So if you can tease that out, even if the model itself is more complex than it used to be, then that gives the client some confidence that you're not completely off base. But you're right as well. So the complexity of a black box model won't suit every purpose as well. So I guess an obvious example is that unless you've got a constrained situation, you might end up with a sum insured curve which is non-monotonic, which means the insurance premium you recommend might go down as someone's sum insured increases, which most insurers tend to not put into their pricing models. I don't know why.
Yeah, like it's an interesting one. I think there's also a role to be played by actual in-market validation. So communication of complexities are really important, and as Hugh sort of said, there's been a large growth of techniques in the last few years as these techniques have become more mainstream in sort of how to communicate that to sort of non-technical people, so that's awesome. But at the end of the day, you're going to implement something in market, and it's going to be potentially a bit black boxy, but if you're implementing it in market with a proper control group, or a proper, alternative treatment that you maybe isn't as black boxy, and you're directly measuring the result of the black box. If it's better than the alternative, then the fact that it's a black box becomes a bit less of a problem.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Emily. So I have a question more around the tools and the softwares out there. So, of course, the more you know about it, the better. But my question is around if you're actually wanting to be more in the management space of things, of course you need to be aware of what's out there, what are the latest top tools and software, and be able to talk about it. But my question is, do you actually need to know how to do it yourself?
So I'm going to talk from personal experience. So Tarek Ryan and companies where I've sort of worked with managers, you tend to get two types of managers, and so ones who sort of understand the mechanics quite well, and so you explain, well, I've got a problem, and they'll say, well, why is that a problem, and you sort of keep explaining and they keep understanding, and managers who sort of don't want to engage at that sort of more technical level. And both styles can work, so I'm not going to sort of, I'm going to hedge my bets and say that it can both work. I prefer to deal with the more technical ones, but I'm a more technical person, so I would say that. Certainly, when you think of the really successful managers, I think they have a very hands-on approach, maybe.
Yeah, I think management, you'll need sort of the leadership skills as well, or just leadership, I don't know, there's two sides to it. And the Institute is running a leadership development forum in a few weeks' time, so we'd like to come to that. You'll hear about, actuaries who've made successful careers out of management and the things that made them successful, it didn't used to be, I learned how to use SAS 20 years ago. It's the leadership skills, I think.
I think it's important to have a good technical grounding. I think there's a distinction between literally knowing how to write every line of code yourself and the sort of high-level conceptual understanding of what's actually going on. You can have a good technical conversation with someone who literally can't write code but understands the mathematics and the logic. And I think that's probably more important in a manager than someone who can actually, physically write a program, but it's kind of handy if they can sometimes.
I guess I'd comment as an experienced actuary, I wouldn't know what to do with SAS now, but that's what I guess the job of the young actuary is, and ultimately when you get more experienced, you are more interpreting the information rather than doing it. But I guess we still need people to be learning the tools, and I guess firms have to also subscribe to those tools, don't they? Like Tableau, I guess that's one of the things that are being used, or the visualisation tools and techniques seem to be very popular at the moment. Any other questions?
Thomas here from Suncorp. Just a question for you, actually. In your spectrum of different software, you know, programs that people have been using, there's obviously a lot of them that are proprietary and people have to pay for, and more recently it's the open source that seems to be getting more prominent, but you still get very varying sort of comments from people, you know, depending on what they're trying to sell you. Don't go open source because it's not as stable, things keep changing, and you know, you can't build an enterprise solution on some of these open source platforms. And on the flip side, you look at some of the, you know, really cutting edge stuff that's been done. It's been done on open source. What's your overall view of, you know, stability and reliability?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there'll always be that risk management angle that if everything doesn't work, at least if I'm paying for the software, I can call up the company and tell them to fix it. And I think that is part of the attraction. With open source, you do have to back your staff and your own talent a little bit more that says, well, yes, sort of everything's open, so if there is an issue, we'll be able to figure out how to overcome it. And I think that is the case. Like, usually that you can solve problems with open source software just as well as proprietary software. And so on that basis, like, I personally like open source software. I like R better than SAS just because you need fewer lines of code more than anything else, and sort of it's just a nicer environment to write. And I've never had an issue with R being unreliable in the sense that it sort of doesn't produce the right answer. Like, it still fits a GLM just as well as SAS will fit a GLM.
So. I think it's important to also reflect that, you know, you're talking about insurance companies, and that the problems that you're trying to solve are, you know, reasonably familiar problems to the world that have already been solved thousands of times before in these open source packages. So, you know, you get a package in R that's been used by millions of people to solve millions of different problems and can also solve your problem, which is pretty much always the case, then I don't think robustness is as much of an issue as, say, if you were, I don't know, Google doing something new and crazy that no one's ever tried before. It's a bit different, right? So you need to think about the sort of problems that you're solving and how sort of familiar they are as sort of problems. And they've been solved thousands of times before, so it's not that much of an issue.
No more questions? Okay, thank you very much for participating in the Q&A. Could you just wait for a moment? Also, thanks to PwC for sponsoring Plenary One, and we'll now have afternoon tea and returning at about 3:40.